I'm talking with John Foster, and John is the author of a couple of books that I think are absolutely fantastic because they give you a really broad range background behind what can happen with a UFO ET encounter. And I don't know if our language is correct with this, but we're going to work with what we've got. It has to do with being aware that what we see in our reality isn't necessarily everything that's present. And when you have somebody who's had a behind-the-scenes overview, and John is in his 80s now, and this happened, began when he was a small child, that person giving us this entire history as a frame of reference is absolutely a treasure. Okay, so this is a diamond that we're looking at that is pure and essential if you want to know more about what's happening to us as a species, with our consciousness, our evolution, our growth, spiritual, physical, mental, the whole nine yards. This is the little thing, the key to our evolution, okay? Because it's happening behind the scenes on a grand scale. And I loved seeing John's information, finding him, and thinking, oh my gosh, here it is, right here in plain view, because John has left a wonderful trail of breadcrumbs to give us some, I think, insight to behind the scenes of how this works. Eminent Discovery, he originally put these out, just getting them out of his head and into the mix, and then went through and revamped. So Eminent Discovery Volume 2 is the one we're going to be referencing, and then To Earth from Heaven, two books that give you, just tons and tons of information. But John, I wanted him, I'm like, John, I have your information, I've been on your website, I've seen your YouTube videos, I've seen the presence of, you know, all this information, but I still want to hear from the person, because this is how oral histories are huge throughout our centuries of being here on the planet. And when we share our stories, we engage in a different way. So, John, I am so glad. Thank you very much for talking with me, because you have an absolutely astounding story.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Wendy, because you have a lot of insight, and most people really don't want to hear about this. And I've gone... My case is a little bit different than most in the respect that I didn't really know what was going on until I was 48 years old, and that was 1986. And I was outside on the patio one night, and during the 80s, I would have strange feelings that I knew something was going on, and I actually had those feelings all my life. But it was stronger in the 80s, so I was outside on the patio and I saw the city lights reflecting from the clouds up above, and it just really made me uncomfortable. And so I went in and went to bed, and I remembered that some people remembered their UFO encounters after being hypnotized, so I decided I would try to concentrate and remember if I had ever had an encounter, and almost immediately a picture flashed in my mind's eye, and I saw a winged saucer flying above me, and so I tried to understand what happened before that and after that, and it was a chain reaction, and there was just a flood of memory that started to come back about that encounter. And that was at the Bethany Grade School playground here in Lincoln, Nebraska. That encounter is Chapter 2 in the Eminent Discovery Volume 1, if anybody's interested. And there were several things that just shocked me, because it indicated that we had a contact with beings and crafts and strange objects that we don't normally see. And to give you an example, during that Bethany encounter, there was a crowd of 30 to 50 people there, and the craft, to make a long story short, the craft hovered above us, and the voice started speaking to us from the craft. And he said that they were going to take 5 or 6 of us aboard, but not to be afraid, because they could make us forget the experience if that's what we wanted. And then he introduced the first person that they were going to take up, and it was a young gal who had just graduated from college, a nearby college, and she waved and smiled and And then he introduced a couple more people, and it was as if they had dealt with them in the past up the street, you know, where she lived. Mm-hmm. And I was eventually taken up, and I won't go through the whole story. There's extreme detail in chapter two.
Okay.
Anyways, I was put on an examination table, and they told me, among other things, that I would have heart attacks and heart surgeries in the future, and that the veins in my legs would have something to do with it, which has happened now. That was 38 years later. I did have my first massive heart attack and heart surgery, and I eventually lost over half my heart, but that was in 88.
Wow.
And so I survived since then.
Yeah.
For 30 years, and I've just seen my one of my cardiologists, and he said, well, you have more than beat the odds that you're a miracle.
Yes.
So I've lived a lot longer than most people after more than half my heart was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the way it happened, rather than starting at my when I was 2 or 3 years old, which was my first recollections, and possibly before that, because I can remember an encounter where I had diapers on, and our car stopped, and we saw a luminous craft out in the field next to us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So going back to 1986 then, I struggled with this from early September until August. My wife and I took a trip, and I started remembering more. It tells a story in Volume 1 how this all happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then from October, November 86 through February of 87, I just had a flood of memory. It was completely overwhelming, and I would have recollections of other different encounters from the time I woke up until I fell asleep at night. And this even included recollections that when I was supposed to, I was an engineer, as an applications engineer, and I was, of course, supposed to be working, and a lot of my memories took up my time at work, which really wasn't fair to my friend, the owner of the business.
Yeah.
What I remembered is extremely complex and lengthy, and it involves humankind since our very beginnings. It's much more, I was raised as a Christian, and I'm still a Christian, probably have more faith than most people because I have facts to back up what's written in the Bible, sometimes in extreme detail.
Mm-hmm.
My concept is not exactly what your typical Christian would accept, you might say. Do you want me to get into a summary now, or do you want me to explain other experiences?
Part of it is the experiences that you had, they could manifest out of nothing, out of the fog. All of a sudden, this would be present. And there are multiple witnesses, but only a few remember. You talk about the grade school experience. There's also a football stadium experience. And that's what's so fascinating is that, as you describe it, some people saw it. Others people continued doing what they were doing. And some people were engaged. It was the whole spectrum of being there and completely oblivious.
Well, let me explain one of the football encounters. It was a very simple encounter. My wife and I were at a Nebraska football game in the stadium, and was a timeout on the field, and I looked over. We were in the end zone near one of the corners, and I looked over in the corner above the people. There was a manifestation of fog that took place, and it was like a hissing roar. It gradually began to dissipate, and there was a craft. It was what I call a dish-shaped craft with headlights, two headlights on the front, and it manifested above the people, and I could see that the people were looking at it and pointing to it. There was a roar over there, you know, finally.
Mm-hmm.
Then the craft started moving in our direction out in front of us, and we were about halfway up on the stadium. I could see people in front of me pointing at it and asking their neighbor what that was. And so I pointed to it, and I asked Annie, what is that? And she says, well, I don't know what it is. And so we kept looking, and it went over to our right, and then it started going up over the stadium above the heads of people. It was about, I would say, 10 foot to 15 foot above the people. And it finally disappeared over the stadium. And during that time, or before or after that time, I can't remember which right now, but they had called a timeout on the field, and there was a fog that developed on the field, and I believe there was a craft that momentarily manifested, and the referee called another timeout, and they waited until the fog cleared from the field, and then they started playing football again. And I thought that was shocking, you know, why wouldn't people really be interested in what's happening. Anyway, we left the stadium, and as we were walking out, there was a fellow that was talking to his comrades, and he was asking what in the heck that was. And so we stopped and talked to him about it for a time, and then we went on about it, you know, to go home, and we never did hear anything about it in the newspapers or anything like that. And this sort of thing happened many, many times throughout my life. And I'm sure it happened to people also. I gave you the reference to Brad and Sherry Steiger's book, didn't I?
Yes.
The best way to get a handle on the story is to go to johnfosterufos.com. And scroll down and watch the video of a talk I gave to the 2001 UFO conference convention in Laughlin, Nevada.
Okay.
And I covered 6 months on that presentation. I did a lot of the drawings for that. And it explains pretty much in detail the different types of craft and the different types of men. There were a lot of times there would be a strange man that would walk up, or we would find standing beside us, and he would start explaining what was going on and so forth at those times when the craft also showed up. And then there were what I call the lizard-like beings, and I have drawings of that.
Mm-hmm.
They normally piloted the craft, and they actually taught me how to fly the craft two or three times by thinking it forward, so which indicates a different reality, you might say,
mm-hmm.
that's on our reality. Also, what might help your listeners understand a little more is that my father and I were hunting one time, and we saw what I call the large booth in behind Milo Field, I believe it was. And so we stopped, the car stopped. Actually, we didn't stop. Our car stopped, and the door flung open, and there were beings. I don't know if I actually saw them or if they were, it was just the voices that I heard, but they told us we had to get out, and we had to go do something. They didn't really tell us. And so we started moving, not of our own accord, and we were with close to them because we could hear them talking. And so I decided I would try to escape, and I moved off away from them, and they sort of laughed at me and told me that I couldn't do it because I didn't know what was going on, and I wouldn't survive if I didn't stick with them. Kind of a long story, and we had an out-of-body during that encounter, and they showed me and told me how they could manipulate the craft or create the craft by manipulating the atomic and molecular structure of matter. I assume from the molecules and atoms of the haze and fog,
mm-hmm.
because at times we would see what I call the coffin-shaped object sitting on the ground. And several times we went up and tried to touch it, and our hands went through it, and we felt a mild electric shock. Mm-hmm. And then it would move off, and the voice would talk to us, and we would see the lights and so forth. And that's also included in the books and so forth. Do you have any questions now, or
yes.
You want to direct me in a certain...
Yes, I do, because there's an obvious thing where you are... This is intentional. They've selected you, and you're agreeing to go along in your own way. Still, you know, not
sort of, yes.
Yeah, I know. Not like you have much choice with this, but when you're talking about trying to escape and them saying you're not on the same plane, this isn't going to turn out well for you. So just come on. You're with a guy, and this is, I think, at a football stadium encounter where you're with a young man, and the young man kind of creates an opportunity for a rumble, basically. He gets you into an argument, I think, and you go downstairs, and this is a setup. Do you remember, you know the story I'm talking about?
Yeah, that was at a basketball game. The craft actually manifested inside the auditorium, and I was a president of my senior class in high school at Northeast High School here in Lincoln the first semester, and I think it was after the game, all the students kind of gathered in the foyer, which was large, and there were several people there, and there was one of the opponents. Guy's a little scrawny guy, started pestering one of the girls, and it was, you know, he was in a sexual matter. I would look for somebody that would take care of, you know, somebody bigger than I or tougher than I, that would take care of this little guy, and nobody would. And so I told him to back off, and he said, well, I'll just meet you outside. So a friend of mine and I went out. And we went down the stairs by the Coliseum, and there were like 10 guys there, and they were just going to beat us up.
Right.
And a craft showed up, and the voice spoke from the craft, and it threatened the guys, and we saw a chance to escape, so we ran up the stairs and left.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a short encounter that just tells you a lot. I mean, it tells about reality.
Yes. It's incredible. And that's part of what I like about your story is there's an engagement and an interaction here that it doesn't mean they're going to bail you out of every problem, but it means that if there is a reason and a need and you were trying to protect somebody else, that you had a basically a backup many of us don't know about.
Yeah, it kind of still bothers me because they won't show up again, and you know, I want them to come land in the backyard and walk over and let's sit on the patio and have a cup of coffee and you explain to me, you know, what this is all about.
Uh-huh.
Even though I know a great deal about what it's all about. I had one last experience, and I got extremely angry. It was at Maloney Lake at the campground south of North Platte, Nebraska. And to make a long story short, the voice asked me why I was so angry, and I told him, well, it was because I couldn't remember the experiences and it was ruining my more normal life. And as the conversation went on, he said, well, we don't want you, he used the word we, so we don't want you to remember because it would negate the purpose of the encounters. And then after a short period of time, they gave me a choice. They said I could choose to remember and not continue the experiences or not remember and continue the experiences because that's what they preferred because I hadn't developed enough my metaphysical and spiritual talents to be able to carry out my task.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, later I found what my task was through recollection, but even during that last encounter, they levitated me out over the lake, and I saw three people that seemed somewhat familiar, and a large building manifested also out over the lake. It was a masonry building, which is impossible. And so I remember the voice talking to me at that time, trying to get me to decision. And I thought to myself, almost out loud, that, well, I don't have to do anything at all. I can just ignore him, you know. And so that's what I chose to do. And then that was in the summer of 1986, after I had my first recollection of the Bethany grade school encounter. And we went on to the Tetons in Wyoming and Dubois, which was a small city where I worked when I was younger, and we had friends there. I did logging and worked for the Forest Service and broke and trained horses, 1956, 1957. And this was in, of course, 1986. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I started recalling more at that time, but then we went home and we had another trip, and I remembered more and more and more, and then finally in November, I just flooded in. And then the extreme, one of the extreme important things to remember is that after I had recalled all of this in late February, early March, in that spring, I don't know if it was April or May, I went to Shirley McLean's friend who wrote, Shirley wrote Out on a Limb.
Yeah. Yes.
And I met her friend that had been with her in South America, and he talked about UFOs and so forth. Mm-hmm. I walked into the auditorium, and I started recognizing people all around me. And it was so freaky that I got up, and my daughter was with me with a friend, and I got up and stood at the side of the auditorium and tried to look at these people and find out, try to remember who they were. Anyway, I couldn't, and we didn't have a chance to talk to Shirley's friend, but I went home and had more recollections and discovered I had had time travels into the future. And nearly every time, there was a craft that would show up, and there would be the same human individuals on board. And we would fly off to specific location or locations, different locations, but primarily one location where we were shown and told what we were to do in the future. And it involved a vast ET human project that involved other people, of course. And one of my jobs, eventually I learned, was to help with the construction, the design, the construction, and maintenance of some of the buildings. And the buildings were housing units. They were what they called spiritual learning centers and so forth. And one of the first buildings we were to construct was a high school for Central Americans, or people that came across the southern border, especially orphans. And the group that is to help did the teaching, supplying of clothes and food and housing. So after this Shirley McLean's friend's talk, my daughter called me one day. She was living in eastern Nebraska, and she worked with the gal who heard my story, and she wanted to meet me. So she met me, and at that time she explained that I needed to meet with these people that she knew that got together weekly to improve themselves, and that they had, some of them had similar encounters that I did. And later that week, my daughter and I drove to the area, and we drove up to the building, and it just freaked me out because I recognized the building and the landscape around the building. And we were to go to the first meeting, or our first meeting with these people. And it bothered me so much, I took off, and I told my daughter I couldn't, you know, something's wrong. I can't do it. Mm-hmm. But mustered my courage, and we pulled up in the parking lot, went into the building, and I started recognizing the rooms in the building, but no one was there. And all of a sudden, I knew where to go, and I told my daughter to follow me, and we walked through two or three different rooms and opened a closed door, and there were about 12 different people sitting inside. And we said hello and so forth, and we got to talking. I recognized almost everyone in the room. Mm. Some of them recognized me, and we started exchanging stories. And then, they asked me to come back during their meetings, and so I did. And I brought some of my drawings and so forth. Yeah. A couple of the people recognized the drawing of the first building we are to construct and so forth, and I was shocked to find out that they were already adopting Central American orphans and putting them in families, and different families were adopting them, and they were providing education, housing, and food, of course.
I want to get back to what your task was, but what is it like for you with the headlines today with the South American immigrants, and not only that, the huge numbers now that are separated, the children that are separated? Is this reminiscent of what you saw?
Oh, yeah, it's taking place. As I spent, sometimes I would go up and I would spend time three times a week. Things were not developing the way that I thought they should develop. For instance, families were breaking up. There would be a woman that would leave her family and her children to participate in the project. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't go home at night. And there were other things that happened that I didn't think were in the best interest of humankind, you might say. Of course, I realized I was no position to judge.
Right.
But my wife and I, it got so bad, my wife and I separated for about 18 months, and I finally decided that unless they show up again and explain in detail what this is all about, I'm not going to participate. And so I did, and my wife and I got together again, and things have been just great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, project is not developing the way I was shown because of that.
Okay. The other question I have, your task, what was the task?
My task was to design and help with the construction of the buildings. And the buildings were schools, spiritual learning centers, and housing. I wasn't so much connected to the housing as I was the schools and the spiritual learning centers. And so I had some architectural training, and I was a home builder several years. Mm-hmm. And so I drew the plans for the first building, and some of the plans are shown in the Volume 2, I believe, of Imminent Discovery.
Okay, yes.
And there should be some in Imminent Discovery Illustration Picture Books. That book was written, or I published that book because people were not really comprehending the extent of the story, how vast and complex it was. So I did about 170 drawings about what had happened to me, and mm-hmm. I give the location, the time it occurred, and time and date, or the date normally, and have a little explanation about what had happened, and that's in Imminent Discovery Illustration Book. So you can get a kind of a quick overview from that book. And then I wrote, Imminent Discovery, and Neil Sprinkle, who used to hold a UFO conference in Laramie, Wyoming, he's actually part of the reason that I did so much investigation. He was a psychologist that set up the only conference that was oriented to help people like me deal with our encounters.
Yes.
They were helping people all over the world, and especially in the United States. For instance, there were people that were placed in mental institutions because they told their story, mm-hmm. like I did. I really had a fear of being, and I was, professionally, I was a research and development engineer, and I was working for this one company as an applications engineer, and I, of course, that was before my heart attacks, and of course, I didn't want to be exposed so that I would lose my job and so forth and so on. Anyway, what triggered the heart attacks? Oh, I know what triggered the heart attacks. Another psychologist came out to Laramie. He wanted to meet me and hear my story. And then eventually in 1988, he asked me to give a talk to the Psychic Studies Institute in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Fowler Jones. And he was just a kind guy that, understood what was going on. And so I agreed to, when he first asked me that on the phone, I felt a flush of adrenaline just in my body. It was out of fear and partly anger, I think. And I eventually agreed to do the talk, and I gave the talk, I believe, in October, November. I can't remember right now. Anyway, I went down, and he kept the audience small, he said, so that I wouldn't be so afraid.
Right.
And I got to meet some of the people there in Kansas City, and I gave my talk, and everything was fine. And I was invited to go to Unity Church headquarters there near Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
and I met people there, and they were, of course, extremely interesting. Then I came home, and I was, during all that time, except for the talk, I had massive chest pains and a pain in my solar plexus, and my doctors thought I had a hiatal hernia or something like that. Anyway, I came home and then had a massive heart attack and then heart surgery and so forth. So here I am, still alive.
Yes, and that's astounding. Okay, well, I want to go back to, with your experience, your background, and your longevity, you have a broader perspective. You've had a chance to integrate a lot of this, and some people don't have that luxury. They
people
get
don't
it.
Know it in detail like
yes,
I know it.
Yes, and that is why this is so, I think, fantastic, that you're giving us this broader picture, and the fact that they're not telling us for a reason. You know how they give you a problem? Somebody gives you a problem and you have to do your own work?
But
they won't tell you what the end is supposed to be, because if you can't do the work, it won't matter, all right? So you're an example, a living example of someone who was given an opportunity and a challenge to maybe see how this works for humans, period. I mean, we're not all agreeable. And some of the folks you were with said, absolutely no way, no how. And you said, and you kind of took it one day at a time. And so I think with that, there's a value of seeing that the more you allowed it to unfold, the more you were able to see these other people who were also involved and see that this isn't just one person, one continent, one piece of society. It's the planet. That's extraordinary.
Exactly. And I think it was sort of an experiment to see if humankind could handle extraterrestrial, you might say. It would be extra-dimensional, actually, existence with a spiritual connection to entities, intelligent entities, on the other side that we can't see, beyond the veil of the visible, a lot of some writers like to say. So there's a barrier, and we're sort of prisoners within the five senses. And if we don't want to, or if we haven't been touched in some way to realize we don't see that other side of life. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I really wanted to see a UFO before all this happened, before I started recalling. I wanted really bad to see a UFO, and I actually said a prayer to God, the Father of Christ, the creator of the universe, that I knew something was going on. I want to know what the ultimate truth really is, even if it kills me. And I think I said that out loud.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. And, yeah, okay.
And so it was a couple of years before 1986. And,
yes.
And then in 1986, it all happened. So,
wow.
86, 87. And then things happened after that with the who I call the familiar strangers, the people that I rode with in craft into the future to be shown what we are all told and shown what to do in the future.
I want to back up there. In the books, you say you have been shown other things, and because you changed your program, they may not play out. But what can you share about the future that you have seen that still is basically on the table?
Basically, the project, I've met people from all over the world who have had encounters, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there are organizations set up to understand more about the spiritual side of life, you might say. It, of course, goes along with a lot of the things that you have written about and spoke about. However, it's diverse, and I figure, you know, I was in research and development, so I look at things very objectively, and I don't accept things that are not rational or have some kind of evidence that it's true, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read Zachariah Sitchin's Earth Chronicles, and it was sort of a godsend to me because it was a story about ETs developing the world and creating, aiding the creation of humankind.
Yes.
And essentially, that's what I was told twice. I was told that they had helped with the creation of humankind using something similar to test tubes. And so when you think about genetic engineering and so forth, and the Bethany Gray School encounter, for instance, Chapter 2 of Imminent Discovery, suggests that they indeed are doing genetic engineering now and
mm-hmm.
probably have been throughout the centuries. And, of course, they did originally to create the first man and woman. Now, that people are afraid of that because it seems to contradict what's written in the Bible, but I maintain that it doesn't, that it just expands on the knowledge of what is really going on, that there is a God, there is, and you could call him the Father God, and there was the Son, which is Christ, and he was the Son of God who came to earth and to explain to people more about reality and what you shouldn't kill your neighbor, in other words.
Yes.
And you should treat other people as you would like to have them treat you, and so forth. So if you read just the, not necessarily consume everything that's in the Bible, but if you read the words of Christ, it brings you towards closer to the total truth of what's going on.
He's the point of the Bible, the Christ, the message, the Word.
He's the point of the Christian Bible, yeah. I need to tell about the experience at the Sheridan Creek Fire Guard Cabin in 1957. A friend of mine were working as fire guards there, and we had one lengthy encounter where they actually told us what it was all about, and there was no symbolism or vagueness about what they said or what we saw.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially they said they were the monitors or keepers of the earth who were responsible to a hierarchy that included the archangels Michael and Gabriel, who we would refer to as Michael and Gabriel, who were responsible to the entity who we have known as Christ, who is in charge of this corner of our universe. So now you can accept all that. They didn't talk about the Father, the creator of the universe, except you can extrapolate all kinds of things to assume that that is absolutely true. Okay?
Yeah.
And part of the mystery is that I don't know if you're familiar with the Masonic order or not.
Vaguely, but yes.
Okay, well, a lot of people think that it's evil and so forth, but I am a Mason. Before I had my recollections, I became a Mason, and I can tell you that it's one of the best sources for men, especially, to become civilized and kind and generous and so forth. That's the main thrust of the order, the Masonic order. Okay, and women are involved, of course, and I'm not trying to sell this at all because I'm an active member, just like I'm an inactive Christian. I don't go to church much.
But that's okay.
Some of the best, I used to get together with the Familiar Strangers, and we found, even in the talks I've given around the country, there was always a battle on who was the best source or knowledge about who was the most prominent person or could be the most prominent person in the UFO discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of just made me sick, you know, so I backed away. Well, it's sort of a diversion. In other words, there are a lot of spiritual people also that know the answers, you know, and they know the answers, and there's a lot of people that wanted to heal me, and of course in the New Age movement in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a lot of healers around. They wanted to heal. Well, some of it was genuine and some of it was not so genuine, so I decided, of course, along with my decision to back away from the project, is that I would, I always wanted, my mother taught me when I was very, very young to live by the truth, whatever the truth was, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I always sought out the truth, what was real and what was not real. So I backed away from, I gave my last talk at the Psychic Studies Institute in Unity Temple in on the square in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, our kids were remembered encounters, and so I asked them if they would be willing to witness for what they saw and how they felt and so forth. And so our three kids went down with us, and they gave a spiel about the Down on Lake experience, which all three of them remember parts of it.
Yes.
And it's pretty profound. I mean, even though some of their memories are short memories of different episodes, but it's when they told me that they heard the voice speaking to us, and when they saw the craft and how it looked and so forth, I knew in 86 that I knew that what I was remembering was true and accurate.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that I do think is also prominent throughout your stories is that they always had to factor in the Native Americans. There was like a mantra that they repeated over and over again. You were directed to take care of the plants and the animals, the planet. That was a common theme.
Yeah, my dad was the chief of the Nebraska State Fisheries, and he was the assistant director of the Game and Parks Commission. Well, I can tell you one time the experience at Memphis Lake, our whole family, my two sisters and I, we were young teenagers, and there were several things that happened. The UFO showed up, and there was eventually a large, what I call the large booth that hovered above the lake not too far away from us, and we heard my father's friend and a fellow employee in the booth yelling and screaming that he had been abducted. And my father all of a sudden said, he didn't know what to do, but all of a sudden he said, "I know what to do." And he took off his shoes and he waded out into the lake. And a pure blue beam of light came towards him. And when it hit him, he instantly disappeared. We then heard he and the other guy and the voice talking and arguing up in the booth about what to do. as conservation officers.
They were getting a lecture?
They were getting a lecture, yes. And my mother, of course, was afraid, so she put us in the car, and we started to leave. She wanted to save us. And we drove around the bay, and the car stopped, and she couldn't start it. And so we sat there, and I believe I had a time loss at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we woke up, and she was going to take us, the car started, and she was going to get us out of there. And my sisters and I said, no, you can't do that. We have to go back and save my dad.
Yeah. Thanks.
With that, saw him come wading out of the lake, and they told us, eventually they told us to forget all about it, that we didn't have to worry about it, and that was it.
Wow.
And then we didn't talk about it after that.
That's another thing. You were oftentimes told, you know, this isn't, you don't need to remember it, and that's...
Right, exactly. Anyway, we asked the other family about it, and they couldn't remember anything about it in the morning, but they sure did while it was happening, and they were involved also.
Mm-hmm.
And one interesting thing is that they had a young boy a little younger than me, and we were good friends, and they were in, he was the superintendent at Shadman Park in northwest Nebraska. Anyway, we were up there. Am I going on too long here?
No, go ahead.
Okay, we were up there. We used to go up there every year, and we were up there on the in the swimming pool bathhouse, and a boy came in and said there was a helicopter that was on the lawn, above the lawn, at the entrance to the park. So we went out, and we saw a craft with brilliant lights and so forth, and there were things that happened there. And anyway, everybody forgot about it. So I believe it was 1986, I was, of course, worried that everybody would think I was crazy, so I began to think that I needed to contact some of these people that were with me so they could verify to me what happened. Otherwise,
right.
I wouldn't consider I was going crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I picked the most obvious encounter, and that was what I felt was the most obvious encounter. And so I called the guy, and who was a friend I hadn't seen for decades, and I asked him about it, and he said, oh, sure, that was a helicopter above the lawn at the entrance to the park. And I said, well, tell me, it described what it was, and he started to describe it, and he said, no, it couldn't have been a helicopter because I don't remember the popping sound. It was kind of a horror sound.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked lights and so forth, and he finally knew that it wasn't a helicopter. And which was really a relief for me because I knew that I was on to something. Anyway, later, I think it was 1 or 2 years later, I met with him at in a hotel here in Lincoln, and I took my drawings, and we talked for a while, and I recorded his statements, and I threw a bundle of drawings out on the table, and I had to go to the bathroom, and I went to the bathroom, and I heard him yell, this is what I saw, and he picked up the exact drawing out of a stack of 30 to 50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, validation.
Yeah.
We're going to have to wrap, but what I want to say is that your drawings and your extensive, explicit recollections, these are, for some people, will be a lifesaver because it's going to validate other people who've been afraid to talk and don't know who to talk to and need some kind of indication that what they're experiencing isn't fiction or some kind of psychological issue, all right? And that's what you've had a chance to work through with the fact that you saw this in the company of others who've been given, you know, in some way, shape, or form, acknowledgement for saying, yes, this is what's happening, this is what's going on. What would your message be now to people who are experiencing this? What have you learned?
Well, if I would put myself in their position, I would just state that We don't totally know what's going on. We have to live life through faith. And the best thing that I've run across is that, you know, that there is a creator, and then you have to have faith that the creator is going to take care of you. And also that you are part of that creation, that we are all creators of our own world. So we have to make decisions about what we want to do the next minute or tomorrow or for the next year or whatever. So we live in isolated worlds from one another, but we also have contact, and we need to struggle with the good times and the bad times. The bad times are really good teachers,
yeah.
And so have faith and get through them. The church is really good for some people, and for some people it's probably not so good, but there are other people around. If you talk, we used to get together with the familiar strangers, and they put me in charge of the conversation, and so I would tell them that everyone has a story. So there was normally a person that would want to take over and control the group. So I would say, well, let's just take 10 minutes and go around the room, and everybody say whatever they want to say, and then we'll go around again, and then we would say, okay, if there's anybody that wants to talk longer, now's the time. Mm-hmm. So they would talk and tell their story. And if everybody didn't get to talk that time, we would make sure they got to talk the next time. And then we would dismiss, and we'd have lunch. And this was normally on a Sunday. And we would just kind of talk to whoever we wanted to talk to. And people would come out of that and say, this is better than going to church, that I've learned more today than I have all those times I went to church. So it's connected for sure to the goodness of life, but they use whoever's controlling or whoever set it up also wants us to experience conflict,
yeah,
and discourse.
Yes.
And that way we learn what the goodness of life is, and we grow towards a more eternal life, you might say.
Do you think they plan to, at some point, make themselves more visible? And it seems to me that that's what this is progressing to, that we are evolving to be able to accept not only the others that are unlike us on this planet, and technically that's where this is going, and that way we could accept others who are not of this universe.
Yeah, well, I think there will be some of that, although I'm not sure that it would include everybody on Earth. I think people are at different stages of development, and that's one reason that America is so wonderful, is that you can decide, being a creator also, you can decide what you want to do and how you want to feel.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, in the ultimate end, it's how you feel and who you are.
Yeah.
And what your emotional feelings and also your spiritual emotional feelings beyond the body is the most important thing. So if you have goodness in your heart and that's the ultimate goal, then you're okay. No matter what happens.
My interview with John Foster, this is a full version. I had to edit the other version that aired on KCMO because of time constraints. So this is actually more of our conversation. The fantastic drawings he has are included on his website. You'll see incredible accounts of his lifetime of memories from the time he was a kid to 48 years old when he said, I'm done with this. Please, I can't deal with it anymore unless you give me full disclosure on what the purpose is. So on the website at johnfosterufos.com, you'll find more of his story, more details. You can also get the books available on Amazon, Eminent Discovery Volume 1 and 2, and that is just absolutely astounding what he was able to remember. And as you heard, it gave him 3 heart attacks. This blew him out of the water. So for more information, again, check out John's website, johnfosterufos.com, an extraordinary story. I've included interview links on my blog, wendyscoffeehouse.com, and you can check that out there as well, trying to highlight some of the things. I bought one of John's prints, and I'm really excited to see that because it's the one where the UFO comes out of the cloud. And this suggests our reality is completely unlike anything we believe at the moment. To experience this firsthand is why I wanted to hear from John in his own words what it was like, because hearing the story from the experiencer, I think, gives it so much more credibility. Anyway, I really appreciate John taking time to talk with me, and hopefully I'll be able to connect with him again. But for right now, you can check out his information again, johnfosterufos.com, and find out more details about his incredible lifetime of encounters. Very much worth reading and investigating and exploring and comparing notes with other experiencers as well. Because as he says, this is ongoing. I'm Wendy. Wendy's Coffeehouse, KCMO Talk Radio.